after that red spot on their bills.
It's not the same bird, of course. I've gone through a few generations of Big Reds myself, but there, the one on the left, that's Big Red today.
She tried to connect with the sister who had given her the gulls, but all she could see was the face in the painting,
which was more than she'd had before. The red spot on a herring gull's bill, Kaya knew, was more than decoration. Only when the chicks pecked at the spot with their bills would the parent release the captured food for them. If the red spot was obscured so that the chicks didn't tap it, the parent wouldn't feed them and they would die. Even in nature, parenthood is a thinner line than one might think. They sat for a moment. Then Kaya said,
I just don't remember much about it at all.
You're lucky, then. Just keep it that way. They sat there like that, quietly, not remembering. She cooked a southern supper as Ma would have. Black-eyed peas with red onions, fried ham, cornbread with cracklin', butter beans cooked in butter and milk. Blackberry cobbler with hard cream with some bourbon Jody brought. As they ate, he told her he would like to stay a few days if that was okay, and she said he was welcome as long as he liked.
This is your land now, Kaya. You earned it. I'm stationed at Fort Benning for a while yet, so I can't stay long. After that, I'll probably get a job in Atlanta so we can stay in touch. I'd like to see you as often as I can get up here. Knowing you're okay is all I ever wanted in my life.
I'd like that, Jody. Please come whenever you can.
The next evening, as they sat on the beach, wave tips tickling their bare toes, Kaya chatted in unusual fashion, and Tate seemed to be in every paragraph. There was the time he showed her the way home when she, as a little girl, was lost in the marsh, or the first poem Tate read to her. She talked about the feather game and how he taught her to read, how he was a scientist at the lab now. He was her first love, but he had dropped her when he went to college, left her waiting on the lagoon shore, so it had ended.
How long ago was that? Jody asked.
About 7 years, I guess, when he first went to Chapel Hill.
Did you ever see him again?
He came back to apologize, said he still loved me. He was the one who suggested I publish reference books. It's nice to see him now and then in the marsh, but I'd never get involved again. He can't be trusted.
Kaya, that was 7 years ago. He was just a boy. First time away from home, hundreds of pretty girls around. If he came back and apologized and says he loves you, maybe you should cut him a little slack.
Most men go from one female to the next. The unworthy ones strut about, pulling you in with falsehoods, which is probably why Ma fell for a man like Pa. Tate wasn't the only guy who left me. Chase Andrews even talked to me about marriage, but he married someone else. Didn't even tell me. I read it in the paper.
I'm so sorry. I am. But Kaya, it's not just guys who are unfaithful. I've been duped, dropped, run over a few times myself. Let's face it, a lot of times love doesn't work out. Yet even when it fails, it connects you to others, and in the end, that is all you have, the connections.
Look at us. You and I have each other now, and just think, if I have kids and you have kids, well, that's a whole new string of connections, and on it goes. Kaya, if you love Tate, take a chance.
Kaya thought of Ma's painting of Tate and herself as children, their heads close together, surrounded by pastel flowers and butterflies. Maybe a message from Ma after all. On the third morning of Jody's visit, they unpacked Ma's paintings.
all but one, which Jody kept, and hung some on the walls. The shack took on a different light, as though more windows had opened up. She stood back and stared at them. A miracle to have some of Ma's paintings back on the walls, pulled from the fire. Then Kaya walked Jody out to his pickup and gave him a bag lunch she'd made for his trip. They both looked through the trees, down the lane, everywhere except into each other's eyes. Finally, he said,
"I better get going, but here's my address and phone number,"
as he held out a scrap of notepaper. She stopped breathing, and with her left hand, held herself steady on the truck as she took the paper with her right. Such a simple thing, the address of a brother on a slip of paper. Such an astonishing thing, a family she could find, a number she could call and he would answer. She choked on her own throat as he pulled her to him. And finally, after a lifetime, she sagged against him and wept.
"I never thought I'd see you again. I thought you were gone forever."
"I'll always be here. I promise. Whenever I move, I'll send my new address. If you ever need me, you write or call, you hear?"
"I will. And come back for a visit whenever you can."
"Kaya, go find Tate. He's a good man."
He waved from the truck window all the way down the lane as she watched, crying and laughing all at once. And when he turned onto the track, she could see his red pickup through the holes of the forest where a white scarf had once trailed away, his long arm waving until he was gone. Chapter 34. Search the Shack. 1969.
"Well, again, she's not here,"
Joe said, knocking on the frame of Kaya's screen door. Ed stood on the brick and board steps, cupping his hands on the mesh to see inside. Enormous limbs of the oak, hung with long strands of Spanish moss, cast shadows on the weathered boards and pointy roof of the shack. Only gray patches of sky blinked through the late November morning.
"Of course she's not here. It doesn't matter. We have a search warrant. Just go on in. Bet it isn't locked."
Joe opened the door, calling out,
"Anybody home? Sheriff here."
Inside, they stared at the shelves of her menagerie.
"Ed, look at all this stuff. It keeps going in the next room yonder, and on down the hall. Looks like she's a bit off her rocker, crazy as a three-eyed rat." "Maybe, but apparently she's quite an expert on the marsh. You know she published those books. Let's get busy. Okay, here are the things to look for."
The sheriff read out loud from a short list.
"Articles of red wool clothing that might match the red fibers found on Chase's jacket. A diary, calendar, or notes, something that might mention places and times of her whereabouts. The shell necklace, or stubs from those night buses. And let's not mess up her stuff. No reason to do that. We can look under, around everything. Don't need to ruin any of this." "Yeah, I hear ya. Almost like a shrine in here. Half of me's impressed, the other half's got the heebie-jeebies." "It's going to be tedious, that's for sure,"
the sheriff said as he carefully looked behind a row of bird nests.
"I'll start back in her bedroom."
The man worked silently, pushing clothes around in drawers, poking in closet corners, shifting jars of snake skins and shark's teeth in search of evidence. After 10 minutes, Joe called,
"Come look at this."
As Ed entered the porch, Joe said,
"Did you know that female birds only got one ovary?" "What are you talking about? See, These drawings and notes show that female birds only got one ovary. Dang it, Joe. We're not here for a biology lesson. Get back to work.
Wait a second. Look here. This is a male peacock feather, and the note says that over eons of time, the male's feathers got larger and larger to attract females, until the point the males can barely lift off the ground. Can't hardly fly anymore.
Are you finished? We have a job to do.
Well, it's very interesting.
Ed walked from the room.
Get to work, man.
10 minutes later, Joe called out again. As Ed walked out of the small bedroom toward the sitting room, he said,
Let me guess. He found a stuffed mouse with 3 eyes.
There was no reply. But when Ed walked into the room, Joe held up a red wool hat.
Where do you find that?
Right here, hanging on this row of hooks with these coats, other hats, and stuff.
In the open, like that.
Right here, like I said.
From his pocket, Ed pulled out the plastic bag containing the red fibers taken from Chase's denim jacket the night he died and held it against the red hat.
They look exactly the same. Same color, same size and thickness,
Joe said as both men studied the hat and sample.
They do. Both of them have fuzzy beige wool mixed in with the red.
Man, this could be it.
We'll have to send the hat to the lab, of course. But if these fibers match, we'll bring her in for questioning. Bag and label the hat.
After 4 hours of searching, the men met in the kitchen. Stretching his back, Ed said,
I reckon if there's anything else, we would have found it by now. We can always come back. Call it a day.
Maneuvering the ruts back to town, Joe said.
Seems like if she's guilty of this thing, she would have hidden the red cap, not just hung it in the open like that.
She probably had no idea fibers would fall off the hat onto his jacket, or that the lab could identify them. She just wouldn't know something like that.
Well, she might not have known that, but I bet she knows a bunch. Those male peacocks strutting around, competing so much for sex they can't hardly fly. I ain't sure what it all means, but it adds up to something.
Chapter 35 The Compass, 1969. One July afternoon in 1969, more than 7 months after Jody's visit, The Eastern Seacoast Birds by Catherine Danielle Clark, her second book, a volume of stark detail and beauty, appeared in her mailbox. She ran her fingers over the striking jacket, her painting of a herring gull. Smiling, she said,
Hey, Big Red, you made it to the cover.
Carrying the new book, Kaya walked silently to the shady oak clearing near her shack, searching for mushrooms. The moist duff felt cool on her feet as she neared a cluster of intensely yellow toadstools. Mid-stride, she halted. There, sitting on the old feather stump, was a small milk carton, red and white, just like the one from so long ago. Unexpectedly, she laughed out loud. Inside the carton, wrapped in tissue paper, was an old army-issue compass in a brass case, tarnished green-gray with age. She breathed in at the sight of it. She had never needed a compass because the directions seemed obvious to her. But on cloudy days, when the sun was elusive, the compass would guide her. A folded note read,
Dearest Kaya, this compass was my grandpa's from the First World War. He gave it to me when I was little, but I've never used it, and I thought maybe you would get the best out of it. Love, Tate.
P.S. I'm glad you can read this note.
Kaya read the words, dearest and love again. Tate. The golden-haired boy in the boat, guiding her home before a storm, gifting her feathers on a weathered stump, teaching her to read. The tender teenager steering her through her first cycle as a woman and arousing her first sexual desires as a female. The young scientist encouraging her to publish her books. Despite gifting him the shell book, she had continued to hide in the undergrowth when she saw him in the marsh, rowing away unseen. The dishonest signals of fireflies, all she knew of love. Even Jody had said she should give Tate another chance. But every time she thought of him or saw him, her heart jumped from the old love to the pain of abandonment. She wished it would settle on one side or the other. Several mornings later, she slipped through the estuaries in an early fog, the compass tucked in her knapsack, though she would not likely need it. She planned to search for rare wildflowers on a wooded tongue of sand that jutted into the sea, but part of her scanned the waterways for Tate's boat. The fog turned stubborn and lingered, twisting its tendrils around tree snags and low-lying limbs. The air was still. Even the birds were quiet as she eased forward through the channel. Nearby, a clonk-clonk sounded as a slow-moving oar trapped a gunwale, and then a boat emerged, ghoul-like, from the haze. Colors, which had been muted by the dimness, formed into shapes as they moved into the light. Golden hair beneath a red cap, as if coming in from a dream, Tate stood in the stern of his old fishing boat pulling through the channel. Kaya cut her engine and rowed backward into a thicket to watch him pass. Always backward to watch him pass. At sundown, calmer, heart back in place, Kaya stood on the beach and recited, "Sunsets are never simple. Twilight is refracted and reflected, but never true. Eventide is a disguise, covering tracks, covering lies. We don't care that dusk deceives. We see brilliant colors and never learn the sun has dropped beneath the earth by the time we see the burn. Sunsets are in disguise, covering truths, covering lies." A.H. Chapter 36 To Trap a Fox, 1969. Joe walked through the opened door of the sheriff's office.
"Okay, got the report. Let's have a look."
Both men scanned quickly to the last page. Ed said,
"That's it. A perfect match. Fibers from her hat were on Chase's jacket as he lay dead."
The sheriff slapped the report across his wrist, then continued.
"Let's review what we have here. Number one, the shrimper will testify that he saw Miss Clark boating toward the fire tower just before Chase fell to his death. His colleague will back him up. Two, Patty Love said Miss Clark made the shell necklace for Chase, and it disappeared the night he died. Three, fibers from her hat were on his jacket. Four, motive. The woman wronged. And an alibi we can refute. That should do it."
"A better motive might help," Joe said. "Being jilted doesn't seem like enough.
It's not like we're finished with the investigation, but we have enough to bring her in for questioning. Probably enough to charge her. We'll see how it goes once we get her here."
"Well, that's the problem, isn't it? How? She's outrun everybody for years. Truant officers, census takers, you name it. She's outwit them all, including us. We go out there chasing her through swamp grass, we'll make fools of ourselves."
"I'm not afraid of that. Just because nobody else could catch her doesn't mean we can't. But that wouldn't be the smartest way of doing it. I say we set a trap."
Oh, yeah. Well,
the deputy said,
I know a thing or two about trapping. And when you go to trap a fox, it's usually the trap that gets foxed. It's not like we have surprise on our side. We've been out there knocking on her door enough to scare off a brown bear. What about the hounds? That'd be a sure thing.
The sheriff was silent a few seconds.
I don't know. Maybe I'm getting old and soft at the grand old age of 51, but running down a woman with hounds for questioning doesn't seem right. It's fine for escaped convicts, people already convicted of some crime, but like everybody else, she's innocent until proven guilty, and I can't see setting hounds on a female suspect. Maybe as a last resort, but not yet. Okay, what kind of trap? That's what we got to figure out.
On December 15th, as Ed and Joe discussed options of how to bring Kaya in, someone knocked on the door. The large form of a man loomed behind the frosted glass.
Come on in, the sheriff called.
As the man stepped inside, Ed said,
Well, hello, Rodney. What can we do for you?
Rodney Horn, a retired mechanic, spent most of his days fishing with his pal Denny Smith. The villagers knew him as quiet and settled, always in bib overalls, never missed church, but wore his overalls there as well, with a nice fresh shirt ironed and starched stiff as a plank by his wife Elsie. Rodney took off his felt hat and held it in front of his belly. Ed offered him a chair, but Rodney shook his head.
This won't take long, he said. Just something might be relevant to the Chase Andrews thing. What you got?
Joe asked.
Well, it was a while back now. Me and Denny were out fishing on August 30th this year, and we seen something out at Cypress Cove. Think it might be of interest to you. Go ahead, the sheriff said. But please, sit down, Rodney. We'd all feel more comfortable if you sat.
Rodney took the chair offered, and for the next 5 minutes, told them his story. After he left, Ed and Joe looked at each other. Joe said,
Well, now we've got motive. Let's get her in here.
Chapter 37, Gray Sharks, 1969. Just days before Christmas, and earlier in the morning than usual, Kaya motored slowly and quietly toward Jumpin's. Ever since the sheriff or his deputy had been sneaking out to her place, trying to catch her at home, failed efforts she'd observed from the palmettos, she'd bought her gas and supplies before first light, when only fishermen were about. Now, low clouds scudded just above a sloshing sea, and to the east, a squall, twisted tightly like a whip, threatened from the horizon. She'd have to finish at Jumpin's quickly and get home before it hit. From a quarter of a mile out, she saw his wharf billowed in with fog. She slowed even more and looked around for other boats in the soggy quiet. Finally, at about 40 yards out, she could see Jumpin's form in the old chair leaning against the wall. She waved. He did not. He did not stand. He shook his head slightly. Just a whisper. She let go of the throttle. She waved again. Jumpin stared at her, but did not move. Jerking the stick, she turned abruptly back toward the sea. But coming in from the fog was a large boat, the sheriff at the helm, another couple of boats flanking, and just behind them, the squall. Gunning her engine, she threaded the needle between the oncoming rigs, her boat banging white caps as she raced for the open sea. She wanted to cut back toward the marsh, but the sheriff was too close. He'd catch her before she got there.
The sea no longer swelled in symmetrical waves, but tossed in confusion. The water grew meaner as the edge of the storm engulfed her. In seconds, it released a torrent. She was soaked through, long strands of hair stringing across her face. She turned into the wind to keep from capsizing, but the sea pushed over the bow. Knowing their boats were faster, she hunched forward into the ragged wind. Maybe she could lose them in this soup or dive into the sea and make a swim for it. Her mind raced through the details of jumping in, which seemed her best chance. This close to shore, there'd be a backwash or rip, which would zip her along underwater much faster than they'd think she could swim. Popping up to breathe now and then, she could get to land and sneak out on a brushy shore. Behind her, their motors raced louder than the storm, getting closer. How could she simply stop? She'd never given up. She had to jump now. But suddenly, like gray sharks, they massed around her, pulling close. One of the boats whipped in front of her and she rammed its side. Thrown back against the outboard, her neck jerked. The sheriff reached out and grabbed her gunwale, all of them wallowing in the churning wakes. Two men swung into her boat as the deputy said, "Miss Catherine Clark, you're under arrest for the murder of Mr. Chase Andrews. You have the right to remain silent." She didn't hear the rest of it. No one hears the rest of it. Chapter 38 Sunday Justice, 1970. Kaya's eyes blinked shut against sharp light that poured from overhead lamps and windows as tall as the ceiling. For 2 months, she'd lived in dimness, and now, opening her eyes again, caught a soft edge of the marsh outside. Rounded oaks sheltering scrub-sized ferns and winter holly. She tried to hold the vital green a second longer, but was led by firm hands toward a long table and chairs where her attorney, Tom Milton, sat. Her wrists were cuffed in front, forcing her hands into an awkward prayer pose. Dressed in black slacks and a plain white blouse, with a single braid falling between her shoulder blades, she didn't turn her head to look at the spectators. Still, she felt the heat and rustle of people knotted into the courtroom for her murder trial. Could sense people's shoulders and heads waggling to catch a glimpse of her, to see her in handcuffs. A smell of sweat, old smoke, and cheap perfume increased her nausea. Coughing noises ceased, but the hubbub rose as she neared her seat. All distant sounds to her, because mostly she heard the sickness of her own jagged breathing. She stared at the floorboards, highly polished heart pine, while the cuffs were removed, and then sat heavy into the chair. It was 9:30 a.m. on February 25, 1970. Tom leaned close to her and whispered that everything would be all right. She said nothing, but searched his eyes for sincerity, anything to hang on. Not that she believed him, but for the first time ever she had to put herself in the charge of another. Rather tall for 71 years, he wore his thick white hair and frumpy linen suits with the accidental if cliched grace of a country statesman. He moved gently and spoke quietly behind a pleasant smile that lived on his face. Judge Sims had appointed a young attorney for Miss Clark, since she had taken no action to do so herself. But when Tom Milton heard of this, he came out of retirement and requested to represent her pro bono. Like everyone else, he had heard stories about the Marsh girl, and over the years had seen her occasionally, either drifting sleekly through waterways as part of the current, or scurrying from the grocery like a coon from a rubbish bin. When he first visited Kaya in jail 2 months ago, he'd been led into a small dark room where she sat at a table. She had not looked up at him. Tom had introduced himself, saying he would represent her, but she didn't speak or raise her eyes. He had an overpowering urge to reach out and pat her hand, but something,
Maybe her upright posture or the way she stared, vacant-eyed, shielded her from touch. Moving his head at different angles, trying to capture her eyes, he explained the court procedures, what she should expect, and then asked her some questions. But she never answered, never moved, and never looked at him. As they led her from the room, she turned her head and glimpsed through a small window where she could see the sky. Seabirds shrieked over the town harbor, and Kaya seemed to be watching their songs. On his next visit, Tom reached into a brown paper bag and slid a glossy coffee table book toward her. Titled The Rarest Shells of the World, it opened to life-sized oil paintings of shells from the most distant shores on Earth. Her mouth partly open, she turned slowly through the pages, nodding at particular specimens. He gave her time. Then, once again, he spoke to her, and this time she looked into his eyes. With easy patience, he explained the court procedures and even drew a picture of the courtroom, showing the jury box, the judge's bench, where the attorneys and she would sit. Then he added stick figures of the bailiff, the judge, and the recorder and explained their roles. As on the first meeting, he tried to explain the evidence against her and to ask about her whereabouts on the night Chase died, but she pulled back into her shell at any mention of details. Later, when he stood to leave, she slid the book back across the table, but he said,
"No, I brought it for you. It's yours."
She bit her lips and blinked.
And now, in the courtroom for the first time, he tried to distract her from the bustle behind them by pointing out the features of the courtroom in the drawing. But diversion was useless. By 9:45 a.m., the gallery overflowed with villagers filling every pew and buzzed with high-pitched comments about the evidence, the death penalty. A small balcony at the rear seated 20 more, and though not marked, everybody understood colored people were restricted to the balcony. Today it was filled mostly with whites, with only a few blacks, this being a white case through and through. Sectioned off near the front sat a few journalists from the Atlanta Constitution and the Raleigh Herald. People who couldn't find seats bunched along the back wall and along the sides by the tall windows, fidgeting, muttering, gossiping. The Marsh girl put up for murder. It didn't get any better than this. Sunday Justice, the courthouse cat, his back black, his face white with a black mask around green eyes, stretched out in a puddle of sunlight in one of the deep window sills. A courthouse fixture for years, he cleared the basement of rats and the courtroom of mice, earning his place. Because Barkley Cove was the first village settled in this torn and marshy stretch of the North Carolina coast, the Crown had declared it the county seat and built the original courthouse in 1754. Later, even though other towns, such as Sea Oaks, became more populated and developed, Barkley Cove remained the official hub for county government. Lightning struck the original courthouse in 1912, burning much of the wooden structure to ashes. Rebuilt the next year on the same square at the end of Main Street, it was a brick two-story with 12-foot windows trimmed in granite. By the 1960s, wild grasses and palmettos and even a few cattails had moved in from the marsh and taken over the once-groomed grounds. A lily-choked lagoon flooded in spring, and over the years had eaten part of the sidewalk. In contrast, the courtroom itself, designed to replicate the original, was imposing. The elevated judge's bench, made of dark mahogany with a colorful inlay of the state's seal, stood under multiple flags, including the Confederate. The half wall of the jury box, also of mahogany, was trimmed in red cedar, and the windows that lined one side of the room framed the sea. As the officials entered the courtroom, Tom pointed to the stick figures in his drawing and explained who they were.
"That's the bailiff, Hank Jones,"
he said
as a lanky man of 60 with a hairline that receded past his ears, making his head almost exactly half bald and half not, walked to the front of the room. He wore a gray uniform and a wide belt, hung with a radio, a flashlight, an impressive set of keys, and a holstered Colt six-shooter. Mr. Jones called out to the crowd,
"Sorry, folks, but you all know the fire marshal's rules. If you don't have a seat, you got to leave."
That's Miss Henrietta Jones, the bailiff's daughter, the court recorder, Tom explained, as a young woman, as tall and thin as her father, walked in quietly and sat at a desk near the judge's bench. Already seated, the prosecuting attorney, Mr. Eric Chastain, unpacked notepads from his briefcase. Eric, a broad-chested, red-headed man of nearly 6 feet, dressed in blue suits and wide, bright ties, purchased at Sears Roebuck in Asheville. Bailiff Jones called,
"All rise. This court is in session. The Honorable Judge Harold Sims presiding."
Sudden silence fell. The chamber door opened, and Judge Sims entered and nodded for everyone to sit, and asked both the prosecuting and defense attorneys to approach the bench. A large boned man with a round face and bold white sideburns, he lived in Sea Oaks, but had officiated over Barclay Cove cases for 9 years. He was generally considered to be a no-nonsense, level-headed, and fair arbitrator. His voice boomed across the room.
"Mr. Milton, your motion to relocate this trial to another county on the grounds that Miss Clark cannot get a fair trial due to prejudices against her in this community is denied. I accept that she has lived in unusual circumstances and been subjected to some prejudice, but I see no evidence that she has endured more prejudices than many people on trial in small towns all across this nation, and some large towns for that matter. We will proceed here and now."
Nods of approval eased through the room as the attorneys returned to their seats. He continued,
"Catherine Danielle Clark of Barclay County, North Carolina, you are charged with murder in the first degree of Chase Lawrence Andrews, formerly of Barclay Cove. First-degree murder is defined as a premeditated act, and in such cases, the state is allowed to seek the death penalty. The prosecutor has announced that they will do so if you are found guilty."
The room murmured. Tom seemed to have inched slightly closer to Kaya, and she didn't deny herself that comfort.
"We will begin the jury selection."
Judge Sims turned toward the first two rows filled with potential jurors. As he read off a list of rules and conditions, Sunday Justice jumped down from the windowsill with a thud and in one fluid motion leapt onto the judge's bench. Absent-mindedly, Judge Sims stroked the cat's head as he continued.
"In capital cases, the state of North Carolina allows a juror to be excused if he or she does not believe in the death penalty. Please raise your hand if you will not or cannot impose the death sentence if a guilty verdict is delivered."
No hands were raised. "Death penalty," was all Kaya heard. The judge continued.
"Another legitimate reason to be excused from the jury is if you have now or had in the past such a close relationship with either Miss Clark or Mr. Andrews that you cannot be objective in this case. Please let me know now if you feel this is true."
From the middle of the second row, Mrs. Sally Culpepper lifted her hand and stated her name. Her gray hair was pulled back severely in a tiny knot, and her hat, suit, and shoes bore the same dull brown.
"All right, Sally, tell me what's on your mind," the judge said.
"As you know, I was the truant officer for Barclay County for nearly 25 years. Miss Clark was one of my cases, and so I had some dealings with her, or tried to."
Kaya couldn't see Mrs. Culpepper or anyone in the main gallery unless she turned around, which, of course, she'd never do. But she remembered clearly the last time Mrs. Culpepper sat in the car while the man in the fedora tried to chase her down. Kaya had been as easy on the old man as she could, taking off noisily through brambles to give him a clue, then circling back and hiding in some bushes next to the car. But Fedora ran in the opposite direction toward the beach. Crouching there, Kaya shook a holly branch against the door, and Mrs. Culpepper looked out the window directly into her eyes. She thought at the time that the truant lady smiled slightly. In any case, she made no attempt to give her away when Fedora returned, cussing up a streak, then driving down the road for good. Now, Mrs. Culpepper said to the judge,
"Well, since I had dealings with her, I don't know if that means I should be excused."
Judge Sims said,
"Thank you, Sally. Some of you may have dealt with Miss Clark in the shops or in official ways, as in Miss Culpepper's case, the truant officer. The point is, can you listen to the testimony given here and decide whether she's guilty or innocent based on the evidence, not on past experience or feelings?"
"Yes, sir. I'm sure I can do that, Your Honor."
"Thank you, Sally. You can stay."
By 11:30, 7 women and 5 men sat in the jury box. From there, Kaya could see them and stole glances at their faces. Most of them she recognized from the village, though she knew few of the names. Mrs. Culpepper sat squarely in the middle and gave slight comfort to Kaya, but next to her sat Teresa White, blonde wife of the Methodist preacher who years ago had rushed from the shoe shop to whisk her daughter away from Kaya as she stood on the curb after having lunch in the diner with Pa. That one and only time. Mrs. White, who had told her daughter that Kaya was dirty, now sat on the jury. Judge Sims called for a lunch recess until 1 p.m. The diner would bring over tuna fish, chicken salad, and ham sandwiches for the jurors, who would eat in the deliberation room. To be fair to the town's 2 eating establishments, the doggone beer hall would deliver hot dogs, chili, and shrimp po' boys on alternative days. They always brought something for the cat, too. Sunday Justice preferred the po' boys. Chapter 39 Chase by Chance, 1969. A fog was lifting from an August morning in 1969 as Kaya motored to a remote peninsula, the locals called Cypress Cove, where she had once seen rare toadstools. August was late for mushrooms, but Cypress Cove was cool and moist, so perhaps she could find the rare species again. More than a month had passed since Tate had left the compass for her on the feather stump, and though she'd seen him in the marsh, she hadn't ventured close enough to thank him for the gift. Neither had she used the compass, though it was tucked safely in one of the many pockets of her knapsack. Moss-draped trees hugged the bank, and their low-hanging limbs formed a cave close to the shore through which she glided, searching the thickets for small orange mushrooms on slender stalks. And finally she saw them, bold and brilliant, clinging to the sides of an old stump, and after beaching her boat, sat cross-legged in the cove, drawing them. Suddenly she heard footsteps on the duff, and then a voice.
"Well, look who's here. My marsh girl."
Whirling around, standing at the same time, she stood face to face with Chase.
"Hello, Kaya,"
he said. She looked around. How had he gotten here? She'd heard no boat. He read her question.
"I was fishing, saw you pass, so landed over yonder on the other side."
"Please just go,"
she said, stuffing her pencils and pad in the knapsack. But he put his hand on her arm.
"Come on, Kaya. I'm sorry about how things turned out."
He leaned in, wisps of breakfast bourbon on his breath.
"Don't touch me."
Hey, I said I'm sorry. You knew we couldn't get married. You never could have lived near town. But I always cared about you. I stayed by you.
Stayed by me? What does that mean? Leave me alone.
Kaya tucked the knapsack under her arm and walked toward the boat, but he grabbed her arm, holding hard.
Kaya, there'll never be anybody else like you, never. And I know you love me.
She ripped her arm from his hands.
You're wrong. I'm not sure I ever loved you. But you talked to me about marriage, remember? You talked about building a house for you and me. Instead, I found out about your engagement to somebody else in the newspaper. Why'd you do that? Why, Chase?
Come on, Kaya. It was impossible. You must have known it wouldn't work. What's wrong with how things were? Let's go back to what we had.
He reached for her shoulders and pulled her toward him.
Let go of me!
She twisted, tried to yank away, but he gripped her with both hands, hurting her arms. He put his mouth on hers and kissed her. She threw her arms up, knocking his hands away. She pulled her head back, hissing,
"Don't you dare!"
There's my lynx, wilder than ever.
Grabbing her shoulders, he clipped the back of her knees with one of his legs and pushed her to the ground. Her head bounced hard on the dirt.
I know you want me,
he said, leering.
No, stop,
she screamed. Kneeling, he jammed his knee in her stomach, knocking the breath from her, as he unzipped his jeans and pulled them down. She reared up, pushing him with both hands. Suddenly, he slugged her face with his right fist. A sick popping sound rang out inside her head. Her neck snapped back, and her body was thrown backward onto the ground, just like Pa hitting Ma. Her mind blanked for seconds against a pounding pain. Then she twisted and turned, trying to squirm out from under him, but he was too strong. Holding both her arms over her head with one hand, he unzipped her shorts and ripped down her panties as she kicked at him. She screamed, but there was no one to hear. Kicking at the ground, she struggled to free herself, but he grabbed her waist and flipped her over onto her stomach, shoved her throbbing face into the dirt, then reached under her belly and pulled her pelvis up to him as he knelt behind.
I'm not letting you go this time. Like it or not, you're mine.
Finding strength from somewhere primal, she pushed against the ground with her knees and arms and reared up, at the same time swinging her elbow back across his jaw. As his head swung to the side, she struck him wildly with her fists until he lost his balance and sprawled backward onto the dirt. Then, taking aim, she kicked him in his groin, square and solid. He bent double and rolled on his side, holding his testicles and writhing. For good measure, she kicked him in the back, knowing exactly where his kidneys lay, several times, hard. Pulling up her shorts, she grabbed the knapsack and ran to her boat. Snapping the starter rope, she looked back as he rose to his hands and knees, moaning. She cussed until the motor cranked. Expecting him to chase after her any second, she turned the tiller sharply and accelerated away from the bank just as he stood. Her hands shaking, she zipped up her pants and held her body tight with one arm. Wild-eyed, she looked out to sea and saw another fishing rig nearby, two men staring at her. Chapter 40, Cypress Cove, 1970. After lunch, Judge Sims asked the prosecutor,
Eric, are you ready to call your first witness? We are, Your Honor.
In former murder cases, Eric usually called the coroner first, because his testimony introduced material evidence such as the murder weapon, time and place of death, and crime scene photographs, all of which made sharp impressions on the jurors. But in this case, there was no murder weapon, no fingerprints or footprints, so Eric intended to begin with motive.
Your Honor, the people call Mr. Rodney Horn.
Everyone in court watched Rodney Horn step onto the witness stand and swear to tell the truth. Kaya recognized his face, even though she'd seen it for only a few seconds. She turned away. A retired mechanic, he was one of them, spending most of his days fishing, hunting, or playing poker at the Swamp Guinea. Could hold his liquor like a rain barrel. Today, as ever, he wore his denim bib overalls with a clean plaid shirt, starched so stiff the collar stood at attention. He held his fishing cap in his left hand as he was sworn in with the right, then sat down in the witness box, hat on his knee. Eric stepped casually to the witness stand.
Good morning, Rodney. Morning, Eric. Now, Rodney, I believe you were fishing with a friend near Cypress Cove on the morning of August 30th, 1969. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Me and Denny were out there fishing. Been there since dawn.
For the record, that would be Denny Smith.
Yeah, me and Denny.
All right. I would like you to tell the court what you saw that morning.
Well, like I said, we'd been there since dawn, and it was near 11, I reckon, and hadn't had a nibble for some time, so we was about to pull our lines and head out, when we heard a commotion in the trees over on the point, in the woods.
What kind of commotion?
Well, there was voices, kind of muffled at first, then louder. A man and a woman. But we couldn't see 'em, just heard 'em like they was fussing.
Then what happened?
Well, the woman started hollering, so we motored over to get a better look, see if she was in trouble.
And what did you see?
Well, by the time we got closer, we seen the woman was standing next to the man and was kicking him right in the...
Rodney looked at the judge. Judge Sims said,
Where did she kick him? You can say it.
She kicked him right in the balls, and he slumped over on his side, moaning and groaning. Then she kicked him again and again in his back, mad as a mule chewing bumblebees.
Did you recognize the woman? Is she in the courtroom today?
Yeah, we knew her all right. It's that and there, the defendant, the one folks call the Marsh Girl.
Judge Sims leaned toward the witness.
Mr. Horn, the defendant's name is Miss Clark. Do not refer to her by any other name.
All right, then. It was Miss Clark we seen.
Eric continued.
Did you recognize the man she was kicking?
Well, we couldn't see him then, 'cause he was writhing and wiggling around on the ground. But a few minutes later, he stood up. And it was Chase Andrews, the quarterback a few years back.
And then what happened?
She came stumbling out toward her boat, and well, she was partway undressed. Her shorts round her ankles and her knickers round her knees. She was trying to pull up her shorts and run at the same time, the whole time shouting at him. She went to her boat. Jumped in and zoomed away, still pulling at her pants. When she passed us by, she looked at us right in the eyes. That's how I know exactly who it was.
You said she was shouting at him the entire time she was running toward her boat. Did you hear exactly what she said?
Yeah, we could hear her plain as day by then, 'cause we were pretty close.
Please tell the court what you heard her shout.
She was screaming, Leave me alone, you bastard. You bother me again, I'll kill you.
A loud murmur shot through the courtroom and didn't stop. Judge Sims banged his gavel.
That's it. That'll do it.
Eric said to his witness.
That will be all. Thank you, Rodney. No further questions. Your witness.
Tom brushed past Eric and stepped to the witness stand.
Now, Rodney, You testified that at first, when you heard those muffled but loud voices, you couldn't see what was going on between Miss Clark and Mr. Andrews. Is that correct?
That's right. We couldn't see him till we moved up some.
And you said the woman, who you later identified as Miss Clark, was hollering as if she was in trouble. Correct?
Yeah.
You didn't see any kissing or any sexual behavior between two consenting adults. You heard a woman shouting like she was being attacked as if she was in trouble. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
So isn't it possible that when Miss Clark kicked Mr. Andrews, she was defending herself? A woman alone in the woods against a very strong, athletic man? A former quarterback who had attacked her.
Yeah, I reckon that's possible.
No further questions.
Redirect?
Yes, Your Honor,
Eric said, standing at the prosecution table.
So, Rodney, no matter whether certain behavior was consensual or not between the two of them, is it accurate to say that the defendant, Miss Clark, was extremely mad at the deceased, Chase Andrews?
Yeah, plenty mad.
Mad enough to scream that if he bothered her again, she would kill him. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's how it was.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Chapter 41. A Small Herd. 1969. Kaya's hands fumbled at the tiller as she looked back to see if Chase was following in his boat from Cypress Cove. She motored fast to her lagoon and limp ran to the shack on swelling knees. In the kitchen, she dropped to the floor, crying, touching her swollen eye and spitting grit from her mouth, then listened for sounds of him coming. She had seen the shell necklace. He still wore it. How could that be?
You're mine,
he'd said. He'd be mad as hell that she kicked him, and he'd come for her. He might come today, or wait for night. She couldn't tell anybody. Jumpin' would insist they call in the sheriff, but the law would never believe the Marsh girl over Chase Andrews. She wasn't sure what the two fishermen had seen, but they'd never defend her. They'd say she had it coming because before Chase left her, she'd been seen smooching with him for years, behaving unladylike. Actin' the hoe, they'd say. Outside, the wind howled from the sea and she worried that she'd never hear his motor coming. So moving slowly from the pain, she packed biscuits, cheese, and nuts in her knapsack and head low against a manic gale hurried through cordgrass along channels toward the reading cabin. The walk took 45 minutes, and at every sound her sore and stiff body flinched and her head jerked to the side, scanning the undergrowth. Finally, the old log structure, up to its knees in tall grasses and clinging to the creek bank, whiskered into view. Here the wind was calmer, the soft meadow quiet. She'd never told Chase about her hideout, but he might have known about it. She wasn't sure. The pack rat smell was gone. After the ecology lab hired Tate, he and Scupper fixed up the old cabin so he could stay overnight on some of his expeditions. They had shored up the walls, straightened the roof, and brought in basic furniture. A small quilt-covered bed, a cook stove, a table and chair. Pots and pans hung from the rafters. Then, out of place and plastic-covered, a microscope sat on a folding table. In the corner, an old metal trunk stored tins of baked beans, sardines. Nothing to bring the bears in. But inside, she felt trapped, unable to see if Chase was coming. So she sat on the edge of the creek, searching the grassy waterland with her right eye. The left was swollen shut. Downstream, a herd of 5 female deer ignored her and wandered along the water's edge, nibbling leaves. If only she could join in. belonged to them. Kaya knew it wasn't so much that the herd would be incomplete without one of its deer, but that each deer would be incomplete without her herd.